You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the Brookings Institution in Exile. This is an event sponsored by the Brookings Intelligence Project. Our guest today is Mr. Malcolm Byrne. I'm extremely pleased to have Malcolm here today. Not only is he a great scholar, he's also a great friend. His official title is Deputy Director and Research Director of the National Security Archive, or NSA. Now, of course, it's not that NSA that he works for. The NSA he works for is one of Washington's greatest gems. It is the place where classified America meets its maker and is hopefully declassified, allowing transparency into government. It seeks to shine a light on what goes on behind the scenes inside of Washington. He is also the co-author of Becoming Enemies, a book about American diplomacy during the Iran-Iraq War, which I think is safe to say is the best book available on American diplomacy in the Iran-Iraq War. He now has a new book, Iran-Contra, which is based on extraordinary amount of research in documents, in diaries, in interviews with individuals, with literally a mountain of material and documents that I don't think anyone else has ever systematically and seriously looked at.
Unless you're a prosecutor.
Unless you're a prosecutor. But in the end, as your book shows, they didn't look at them as well as they should have.
Probably true.
The picture that emerges out of this book, actually it's right there on the cover, changes, I think, our image of Ronald Reagan. And I think it changes it in a somewhat disturbing way. I'll quote from the conclusion, too often the president and his aides took action first, then worried whether it was proper later. And I'd add to proper and legal later. At the heart, of course, of the Iran-Contra scandal were two secret intelligence operations, which is why the Intelligence Project wants to focus light on this, one in Central America and one in Iran. These two intelligence operations were never properly notified to the Congress of the United States. Therefore, almost by definition, they were illegal right from the start, particularly the operation in Iran, but also the operation in Nicaragua. The Iran-Contra scandal had immense consequences. I think that it is safe to say that the march of folly that led to the Iraq War in 2003, and which is still leading to Iraq wars in 2014, can be traced back in many ways to the Iran-Contra intelligence operation that led to the Iran-Contra scandal. Worse, and I think the most disturbing part of this book, is that the oversight system, as Malcolm has already alluded, failed us. We didn't get oversight in the end. We got a lot of hearings, we got a lot of articles in the press, but there was no real systematic effort to prevent future presidents and future White Houses from abusing power. And last but not least, sadly, all of this has haunting, timely reminders today, because the United States once again has hostages being held in the Middle East by extreme Islamist organizations, which have already demonstrated that they are prepared to carry out horrific acts of brutality. Two presidencies, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, were in many ways consumed by hostage issues, and unfortunately Barack Obama looks like he has one today. I'll ask you to turn off your cell phones now, and the formats here today is going to be very simple. I'm going to interview Malcolm for about 40 minutes or so about the book using the prerogative of the chair, and then I'm going to open it up to you all to ask any questions that I wasn't smart enough to think of. So with that as introduction, let me start by asking you about Ronald Reagan. And where do you place him in the saga of the Iran-Contra scandal?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a real honor to be here, both at Carnegie and virtually at Brookings. And it's you know, I'm so happy to be able to talk about this book that I've worked on for a very long time. You're right. This picture of Reagan is emblematic of where I think, you know, of how he comes out of this affair. And where I see him fitting in is right up at the top. It's a very complicated story, as a lot of you will remember as I'm looking across the room here. There's not a lot of 20-somethings in the room, so all of you will remember the hearings and the long, drawn-out process. It was complicated because it affected events in two different countries, well, three different countries, if you include Israel, which played a big part. It involved a lot of wonkish policy issues and a lot of gray, dull legal matters as the affair wound on and dragged on for years and years. So keeping on top of what all the issues were is a real challenge. In judging where Reagan fits, you have to sort of decide what exactly you're talking about in terms of Iran-Contra. Are you talking about, you know, what Reagan knew? Are you talking about what he believed? Are you talking about what people told him? Are you talking about what things happened maybe that were under his radar that Ollie North and others at the NSC staff were doing? It's a multi-layered kind of a story. But to put it as briefly as I can, I see Reagan as being the driving force behind the scandal and both elements of the scandal. On the Iran side, he was guided primarily by his concern for the hostages. He was widely acknowledged to have been emotional and very moved by his meetings with the hostage families in 1985 especially. And this really drove him. He wanted, for personal reasons, but also for political reasons. This is one of the great politicians of the 20th century. There's no doubting that he had political motivations, too. He was intent on finding a solution to the hostage crisis. On the Contra side of things, he was less aware of what was happening on the part of his staff and aides from other agencies. But there seems, in my view, there's no doubt that he provided the guidance and the created the atmosphere in which people like Robert McFarlane, his national security advisor, followed by John Poindexter, Oliver North, and all the others took their inspiration and took their instructions. You remember the famous phrase back in during the congressional hearings where McFarlane said that in 1984, President Reagan took him aside and said, "It's up to you to keep the Contras together, body and soul." This was in anticipation of very stringent restrictions on government aid to the Contras that were about to take place, the infamous Boland Amendment. And it was, as you look back at the record, at least as I saw it, it was clear to everybody, including Reagan, what was about to happen, that this was seen as a virtually complete shutdown of official U.S. Assistance to the Contras. But Reagan was not about to let them go. He was as emotional about the freedom fighters as he was about the hostages, and he was intent on finding ways to get around congressional prohibitions. Whether he understood everything that was to happen was legal or illegal, we can get into to those details, but the basic point is that he was at the top of the pyramid, and without him, I don't think any of this would have happened.
The heart of the Iran affair was trading arms for hostages. Now, America has had a long policy, and we hear it today, we're not going to negotiate with terrorists. How did we end up negotiating with terrorists? And even worse, giving them weapons.
This is part of the complex story within a story. First of all, I just want to say that I was really surprised. A few days ago, I did what I often do, which is I scan the Times website and I look at the Times Minute that they have, these little videos that they put together that are really helpful just to encapsulate particular issues. And there was one a few days ago on hostage matters, and it advertised itself as showing some of the very rare instances where the U.S. has broken with its policy of not negotiating for hostages. Nowhere in that minute plus did the phrase Iran-Contra come into play, or Ronald Reagan. To me, that was not just because I've been buried in this subject for years, but that seems to me to have been the most egregious example of a violation of that policy, and yet it wasn't mentioned. It's just a little reflection of how far in our recesses Iran-Contra has sunk. So how did we get involved in this? There were many different aspects. You know, history, we all know, is not a simple thing. There are many causes in most cases. So several things had to come into play. One was, of course, as we've already talked about, Reagan's emotional attachment to this issue. But early on in the administration, this may come as a surprise, this question had come up about how to deal with Iran. And I can get into that in more detail, but the point right now is that McFarlane didn't come up with this idea by himself. He wasn't the first one to come up with it. There were others before him in other parts of the government who thought this was at least an idea worth considering. But nothing happened until McFarlane was approached by an Israeli foreign ministry official named David Kimchi, who was the director general of the foreign ministry, and you may remember his name. He approached McFarlane in the late spring of 1985 with a message from Prime Minister Shimon Peres to the effect that the Israelis were willing to help the Americans out in an area where they knew they wanted assistance, which was in understanding the new Islamic Republic of Iran. Did the U.S. want any Israeli assistance? And if so, they had some ideas about how to go about this. Now, Peres says that he got this idea from a couple of different coincidences. One was the appearance in Israel of Michael Ledeen, who's well known, I'm sure, to everybody here, who at the time was a consultant to the National Security Council on terrorism issues and on sort of leftist socialist politics in Europe and so on. Ledeen had, according to his account, been told by an associate of his, who he doesn't name, that the Israelis had some ideas about how to approach Iran. So Ledeen, with McFarlane's approval, went to Israel and talked to Peres and a few others to get their sense of things. What do you know about Iran? You know, are there ways to get into, you know, behind the veil, so to speak, and so on. So that was one part of what sort of perked Peres's ears up. The other part was that, coincidentally, just before that, two of the more, you know, dark and gloomy figures of this affair, Adnan Khashoggi and Manachar Gurbanifar, appeared on the scene through a couple of longtime friends of Peres named Adolf Schwimmer and Yaakov Nimrodi. So let's back up a little bit. Khashoggi, everybody knows, was the Saudi billionaire. He was quite the flamboyant figure back then. Gurbanifar was the scoundrel of the affair. He was an arms dealer, shady middleman with ties to who knows who. A lot of people thought it was the Israelis. The Israelis say no way. Other people assumed it was Iranian intelligence. Who knows? He clearly did have some ties with Iranian people in the power structure. So Khashoggi and Gurbanifar come to Schwimmer, the father of the Israeli aircraft industry, and Nimrodi, an arms dealer, but who had been someone who had been stationed in Iran under the Shah and knew Iran very well, spoke Farsi and so on. So through that connection, they raised this idea of, well, you know, maybe we can make some money with Iran. Why? Because Iran is in the throes of its war with Iraq, which had started in September 1980, one of the sine qua nons of this whole affair. If that war hadn't been going on, Iran wouldn't have needed weapons. It wouldn't have been this opening. So through this coincidence of events, not just the war, but the appearance of all of these figures in one place, an external spark exists, and that's in the form of Kimchi meeting McFarlane and telling him, you know, there may be some possibilities here. And during the course of different conversations, the subject comes up of, oh, by the way, you know, maybe the best approach to showing the Iranians your goodwill would be if you had some, were willing to offer some of your weapons that they need. And of course, we all remember that the Shah's military was based on America's, and they still had a lot of Hawk missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, they had TOW missiles, they had all kinds of high-level equipment that the Shah had managed to get out of different U.S. presidents. So this is the spark that McFarland needs, because he's been after this as an idea for a long time. Not because he's so personally interested in the hostages as his main issue. I believe he really did think that there was a strategic opening at hand. In fact, he even wrote about the comparison between the possibility of opening up to Iran with Henry Kissinger's opening to China, and everybody sort of meanly suggested that, well, he thinks he's a Henry Kissinger, fine. I think he really did think that there was a good possibility there, and of course Iran was the most important country in the Persian Gulf for a lot of reasons. So lots of good reasons to try to see what was possible to achieve there. Now, how it got into trading arms for hostages is, again, it comes down to Reagan. Now, Reagan may have been told that this is a strategic possibility and we should explore it. And in fact, he got support in that idea from none other than George Shultz, Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense, who years afterwards, and to this day, Shultz anyway, still being with us, will deny that they ever thought that this was any kind of a good idea. Now, in fairness to them, it was broached as a possible opening. But both of those two senior cabinet officers essentially said, it's okay by us, to McFarland. Go ahead and pursue this with certain caveats, but they gave their okay. So in the summer of 85, Reagan, who's in the hospital at this point, having some surgery done, meets with McFarland, and they discuss this idea over the course of a couple of weeks or so. The discussion continues. It's unclear at first what Reagan thinks, but eventually comes back to McFarland and says, okay, let's do it. So then it's another story of how it goes from there right. to the depths.
Get there. There's one other figure in this that, who you haven't mentioned, and that's the Director of Central Intelligence, Bill Casey.
He's always in the background.
Right. his own agency is saying, we can't trust these people. They polygraph Ghorbanifar. Not that polygraphs are the perfect instrument, but in this case, he's polygraphed repeatedly, and each time it's a more catastrophic failure than the previous lie detector test. And yet, despite his own professional's advice, he keeps pushing this as well. How do you explain his role in all of this, given his unique relationship with Reagan? After all, he was Reagan's campaign manager in the 1980 campaign.
Right. Well, Casey is a critical figure. He helped get Reagan elected. They were old friends. He wanted to be Secretary of State, as some of you will remember, but was not given that job, but took the CIA directorship after he was promised that it would be a cabinet-level post and he would have a lot of influence in policy. And it's no exaggeration to say that when Reagan came into office, Casey hit the ground running. I mean, within a month or two, he had draft presidential findings, which are the documents authorizing covert action, on Reagan's desk in both the Iran case and the Nicaragua and El Salvador cases. Those, in their way, sort of formed the groundwork for what was to come. So if you remember what Iran policy was in the Reagan administration back then, and if you do, I'll give you a gold star, because the short answer is there was no real Iran policy. There were lots of competing ideas. In fact, the Reagan administration, which is a little bit of a surprise probably to some people who remember the how Reagan swept into office and the unifying force that he seemed to be in terms of presenting a new ideology and a new approach to the U.S. role in the world. Behind closed doors and the corridors of the White House and elsewhere, from the testimony of people who experienced it, it was almost pandemonium in both of these areas in particular. On Iran policy, there were basically, as I've reconstructed it, three, not to simplify it too much, but three basic approaches. One was essentially to overthrow Khomeini, and one CIA official who has spoken about this said that they probably got between 30 and 40 offers per year from various exile groups and so on, saying, we can do this, we can get rid of these guys, just give us the weapons, give us the, you know, the wherewithal, and we'll do it for you. Casey was taken with a particular idea that involved some of the Shah's relatives and some old style clandestine activities, like setting up a radio station and broadcasting and seeing about what other kinds of activities they could do to create uncertainty and hopefully dislodge this the Ayatollah. So he, from the get-go, was pretty aggressive in terms of how he wanted to approach Iran. Just very quickly to cover the other two bases in terms of what the policy ideas were. A second approach was essentially to contain Iran. And that gets you into a very thorny issue, which is the U.S. role in supporting Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war. And as Bruce has mentioned, there's a whole book about that that we've both been a part of. A third approach was another kind of old school idea, which sounds antiquated now, but was critical at the time, and all of you remember it, and that was the anti-Soviet approach, where there were clusters of officials, including the White House and including Casey and including Al Haig and several others, who believed that, as Reagan used to famously say, that the Soviet Union is the source of all evil, and it's time to go to the source, and we need to eradicate their influence around the world. And there were great fears at the time that Iran was dead center in Moscow's sights. They had just invaded Afghanistan. It was firmly believed, not just by Republicans, but by a lot of people in Washington and in Europe as well, elsewhere, that next on the list was Iran. We now know from Soviet records that the invasion of Afghanistan was essentially a defensive, desperate gamble on the assumption that it was the United States that was about to go into Afghanistan. So we can talk about perceptions and misperceptions also, but this notion of the Soviet threat was critical, and it suffuses Iran-Contra, and it certainly was critical in Casey's thinking and in his ability to pluck the right chords with President Reagan.
We then have the extraordinary step of the National Security Advisor of the United States going to Iran. We all remember he's armed with a Bible and a cake. Nesta cake.
One of the big myths of Iran.
That's right. That's right. There's no Bible. It's extraordinary to conceive, even though the notion of taking a cake with you. I can't recall another diplomatic mission with a cake. Anyway, there they go. It turns out that the Iranians they think they're going to meet with don't meet with them. And it all comes out, and we now have the investigation. How would you characterize how the Reagan administration approached the business of the investigation? I think the particularly important issue, how to deflect the president from being at the center of this whole thing.
Well, I hope we can go back and talk about some of those details of the trip and so on. As for how they treated the investigation, that takes up a big chunk of this book.
Right.
And it's a crucial part of leading me to the conclusion that I started out with about the role of the president, but also of his top advisors and everybody else involved, pretty much. There are virtually no heroes in this story, unfortunately. It's not a very happy story. Somebody like George Shultz, who was one of the few who repeatedly spoke out against this in Reagan's presence. And I've got actually a couple of documents that, if we have time, I'll read from. They're pretty dramatic. But even he fell prey to the old Washington scandal habit of kind of, you know, retreating into his shell and figuring out a way to try to minimize his exposure in a way that didn't do him justice. I will just throw out the thought that this is another thing that I lay at the feet of Ronald Reagan. In his unwillingness or inability, and it's probably both, to consider the collateral damage of the decisions that he made, one of those bits of damage was the effect that this had on all of the advisors and everybody who worked for him, including Shultz and Weinberger, who did, to their credit, repeatedly say, this is a dumb idea and it's illegal, and you've got to stop it, and Reagan refused. This notion that Reagan had no advice, you know, was hemmed in by nefarious, you know, ne'er-do-wells like McFarlane and so on is absolute nonsense. And the paper record is in the hands of, you know, handwriting of people like Weinberger is very clear on that. But what happened to them, I believe, was that at some point during this investigative process, after the natural reaction of kind of, you know, tightening your defenses and circling the wagons and so on, there was a sense that they not only had to protect the president, they had to start protecting themselves, especially as the independent counsel came in. But in the course of doing both of those, people like Shultz and Weinberger, whatever else you may think of them, and McFarlane, and, you know, CIA folks, Claire George, and all these other people involved, they basically got the short end of the stick, to put it very mildly. And why? Because they were protecting their president and the policies and their party and then themselves. But they were basically thrown under the bus as a result of this. Now, I'm not really answering your question here, but there was a process that took place, if I can try to distill it. Remember that this scandal basically was exposed in three steps. First, in early October 1986, so 2 years after the Boland Amendment, the main Boland Amendment was in place, cutting off allegedly all military aid, directly or indirectly. One of the aircraft that Holly North had organized with General Richard Secord and some of the other folks in this little private Air Force, one of the supply aircraft for the Contras crashed in the jungles of Nicaragua. It was shot down by a 19-year-old kid with an SA-7 thing on his shoulder. He said he was stunned that he actually hit it. It reached its target, crashed, one survivor. They found the Sandinistas found the survivor, Eugene Hassenfuss from Wisconsin, dragged him in front of international TV, and he bared his soul and said, I've been hired by the CIA, and it's, you know, it's an American operation. He wasn't really technically hired by the CIA, but, you know, that's enough to get the ball rolling. And that led to an immediate scramble by those people involved, not just Holly North, who was in the middle of a negotiation with the Iranians, had to cut that short and come back to do damage control. Elliot Abrams at the State Department, a fellow named Alan Fiers, who was their counterpart at CIA, and others, all of whom immediately got together to try to minimize the effect. And the record now shows, despite their testimony to the contrary, that they all knew about North's connections, they all knew about the U.S. connections to that flight and to that resupply operation, and they did their best to try to get the Contras to take credit for it, credit, blame, to get General John Singlob, who was raising money for the Contras, to, you know, take some responsibility. He refused, and I had nothing to do with this. A real uproar, in a quiet uproar, if you will, behind closed doors when that happened. The next event that happens is November 3rd. As we all remember, the Lebanese news magazine Al-Shira gets a hold of this story that undoubtedly comes out of Iranian domestic politics, where somebody who thought that Rafsanjani and some of the other Iranian leaders were losing their taste for the war, found out they were dealing with Americans, decided to spill the beans, circulated a bunch of pamphlets in Tehran advising the population of this. The story gets picked up and printed in a couple of different places, including this Lebanese place, and that gets picked up right away. And, of course, that exposes the arms for hostages deals, which Reagan denies at first. Now, he'll say it was to protect hostages' lives. I have no doubt that that was a big part of it. But what did not come out until long into the investigations was the fact that Reagan's close advisors were terrified that this was going to lead to his impeachment. Why? Because they knew that the first stage of these shipments, of which the public was only gradually learning bit by bit in little pieces, that the first stage of these shipments were undoubtedly illegal. Now, I hesitate because you can quickly get into the gray area of the law, which I'm happy to do if you want. I don't think you want to, but it gets into how the
undoubtedly
administration...
There's at least one lawyer in the room. So we'll...
and I'll probably learn something from him. But it was part of the motivating force that led the administration as a whole down this dark road to lying about what they did, covering up and doing all these things.
Right.
So it, like I say, it's a sad tale. There's several different chapters to it.
We're going to have time to go back to all the details, but I'm kind of eager to get to the end story and the implications.
No.
So here you have Ronald Reagan, fully witting, well aware what he's doing, and arguably impeachable. One of the things that I found very interesting in the book is that the opposition, the Democrats, don't want to go there. So why is it that you know, here's the Democrats' opportunity to bring down a president? I can't imagine in our current Washington that this wouldn't be seized on in a nanosecond. And yet they decide to more or less give him a pass.
It's a fascinating part of the story, and it shows how far we've come in the last number of years. I happen to see that period, the Reagan period, as in some ways, if not the start, because of course you had Nixon and the shenanigans there, then at least a milestone on the path towards the hyperpartisanship and the disjuncture, the dysfunction of official Washington that we have today. If you remember, now, Reagan had many aspects to him, and on the one side was this jovial image of the kind, you know, avuncular chap who wants to bring America together and so on. But remember, he was a highly polarizing figure as governor of California and as part of his campaign. I mean, he wanted to draw a very thick line between his type of thinking and those of the sort of the post-Vietnam, post-Watergate liberals who not only, you know, did he disagree with on virtually everything, but who were, in a sense, responsible for the surge of congressional, power grab that took place in the 1970s, and that's critical to understand in order to understand what happened with Iran-Contra. For all of the feeling that Congress and the executive branch were at war, and that's a statement that Elliot Abrams made famously at one point, he said, we were at war with Congress on Contra policy. There was no two ways about it. But for all of that, I think what was left unnoticed was some sense camaraderie isn't really the right word, but of a need for collaboration among moderate Democrats. Now, there were more hardline Democrats who were out for blood and saw this as their chance to finally get the Teflon president. Finally, he's done something that's going to stick to him. But in addition to that, there was the never-ending sense of self-protection on Capitol Hill as well. It wasn't just in the executive branch. The Democratic leadership was held back on at least 2 points. One was Reagan was still a highly popular president, mm-hmm. even though his ratings plummeted after the scandal, something like 21 points, the worst drop in presidential history, worse than Nixon. He still, even as this was coming about, he was a very popular guy, and they were afraid to confront him too much. They also were very afraid of being seen as soft on communism. This was one of the most successful ploys that the Patrick Buchanans and others in the Reagan administration used, and Reagan himself, when it came time for any kind of a big contra vote on the Hill, there was always heightened rhetoric about, you know, who do you stand with us? Do you stand against us? Are you useful idiots for the opposition, as Buchanan used to say, for the communists? Or are you going to stand up for American values and for the freedom fighters who are in the mold of our founding fathers and that kind of thing? And it had its effect. There's no doubt about it. And it had its effect throughout the presidency, but also in the investigative phase, mm-hmm. where when you look at how both parties chose who was going to be part of the investigating teams. On the Democratic side, it's mostly moderates. You can look at them all. There were one or two people who could be considered, you know, not so moderate. And several of them voted for contra aid in the past. On the Republican side, it was basically attack dogs. There were a few moderates. There were even three Republicans who basically sided with the majority. The Democrats were in the majority at that point. Warren Rudman of New Hampshire, Cohen of Maine, and Paul Tribble of Virginia. They were treated as traitors by Dick Cheney, by Henry Hyde, by Bill McCollum, by Orrin Hatch, by all the other Republicans, because the Republicans clearly, and they will acknowledge it, and Cheney has acknowledged it in his memoir, they saw their job as to defend President Reagan and defend his policies. Now, someone like me, who was pretty young at that stage, I was, you know, watching these hearings avidly, I had to be schooled in the notion that a congressional investigation is about something other than trying to find out what actually happened. Well, guess what? So I happen to believe that the Democrats, by and large, were trying to figure out what happened. Now, of course, it's in their interest to discover things that that don't make the opposition look good. But on the other hand, and if you go back and you listen to those hearings, I think you'll be, well, maybe not in this day and age, but back then it was stunning to see how much of their precious airtime was used up in undermining witnesses for the who were against Reagan and bucking up the president and supporting his policies and so on. Absolutely no interest in finding out what actually happened, whether any laws were broken. The story of their attitudes towards North really put them in the, you know, in the doghouse as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it was shocking even at the time, but to go back and look at it again, maybe even more so, to see in the lead up to North's testimony on Capitol Hill, which is in July of 87, after 2 months of hearings, the Democrats actually did a decent job of constructing an image of how the administration had behaved on the Contras and on Iran. And the proof of that was in the statements that several Republicans included, several members of Congress made in the lead up to North's presentation, both to the media and at the hearings themselves, calling him, you know, just irresponsible and
a rogue.
A rogue, exactly. And just, you know, how did this guy get his job? In comes North, and in the course of less than a week, completely spins the entire room around, the Senate caucus room and the House room, wins over millions of fans among American viewers. You know, Ollie fan clubs get started. Ollie haircuts are being given. Arthur Lyman, the chief counsel for the Senate, is distraught when he comes in one time to see during a break in the proceedings that members of the Capitol Hill police force are there having their picture taken with Ollie. It's just a shambles. And these same congressmen afterwards turn around and it's like night and day. It is shameful. I don't know how they look themselves in the mirror, but you know, it's a sense. I mean, this is, you know, so much of this affair, is typical of what you see under ordinary circumstances. One of my big points in this is that this is not an aberration. It's not the aberration a lot of people think it is. And why? Because the same institutions have been in place for all these years, and the same principles apply in how they conduct themselves. And Congress is a political animal, and they're always going to act this way. So it's part of the danger, part of the warning.
I'm going to go to the audience after one more question, but I do want to just state that I think what you've just heard is one of the great things about reading this book. I know it looks like it's not beach reading, but it actually is beach reading because it's that great a mystery and a puzzle, and Malcolm does a really fantastic job of walking you through this mystery and this puzzle. You mentioned him, so I want to come back to him. Dick Cheney. It's kind of a small figure in all of this, but we'll draw some important lessons from all of this. And could you elaborate a little bit on what Dick Cheney's role is, and more importantly, what Dick Cheney took as his takeaway from the Iran-Contra scandal?
Well, I have many documents I could show, visual aids, but one that I will show you right now is right on point here. It's a document actually from the beginning of the Reagan administration. In fact, before the Reagan administration, it's November 1980, just before the inauguration, but after the election. And these are a set of notes by James Baker, who's going to play a big role in the White House and become Treasury Secretary later. It's notes of his meeting with Dick Cheney. Why? Because Baker's going to be chief of staff. Cheney was chief of staff to Gerald Ford, so he wants to get some pointers from this guy. And one of the things that Cheney says is, let's see, I can't read his writing anymore. Presidency, basically the point is the president's standing has been weakened in recent years. Restore power and authority to executive branch needs strong leadership. That's a quote from Cheney. And then in the margin here, Baker has put six stars next to that and says central theme for the coming years in the presidency. Well, so we see that Cheney has had certain views about the presidency for quite a long time. He carries these views into Iran-Contra. He is a member of the House Republican Investigating Committee. He feels a little bit insulted, by the way, because Senator Inouye on the Senate side has seen fit to name Warren Rudman as his vice chairman of the committee. Lee Hamilton, by all accounts a moderate, refuses to name Cheney his vice chair. It sets off a kind of a running conflict. Throughout the hearings, Cheney makes the point repeatedly that the problem is not the president, the problem is Congress. Congress overstepped its bounds in the 1970s, tried to take over presidential power. It was unconscionable, it was unconstitutional, and it is the cause of a whole lot of serious problems for the American way of doing politics. He repeats this in the minority report at the end of the congressional hearings, and that report gains new life years later when Cheney reminds people who are, this is I think in 2005, so he's been in office as vice president at this point for 4 years, and people in the media and in the public are still trying to figure out, you know, where does this guy come from and what does he really think about all of this stuff. And he points out to the press on, I think, Air Force One at this point, he says, if you want to know what I think and what the serious issues are about presidential power, go back to this little-known manuscript that we put together back in the 80s, and that'll give you a roadmap. And it does. It's a very powerful message about how the real problems are not excesses in presidential power, abuses of power, its abuses by Congress. And I think that explains a lot about the actions that he and President Bush took in the 2000s.
Questions? Please identify yourself, and please, question, not a lecture. Barbara.
That's my job.
Malcolm, thanks very much. Barbara Slavin from El Monitor and from the Atlantic Council. I wanted to focus on the Iran policy aspects of this, which I did in a review I wrote a week or so ago, and still it, I find it just stunning how people in the government can take X and Y and put them together and get, I don't know, you know, C, I'm not sure. You have documents that show people arguing that selling arms to Iran will somehow promote people in the government who want to overthrow the government. At the same time, these same people are expected to get American hostages freed from Lebanon. How in God's name can you reconcile these two things? And how ignorant were officials in the U.S. government about Iran at the time?
Well, they were very ignorant, as you know. And one expression of that was, and they acknowledged it too. I mean, this is why Ladin went to Perez. This is why the idea was, you know, had some traction with a lot of people who thought about these issues, people at CIA and other people in the NSC. Everybody wasn't after hostages alone. There were people who seriously wanted to see an improvement. As I mentioned earlier, in the early part of the administration, this idea had surfaced more than once about getting back into, you know, better relations with Iran and even using weapons to do it. This came up in, 1982, and in 1983, again, there are materials that relate to that. So there was a wide recognition that we really didn't know what was going on there. And a reflection of that is the weight that was given to a document that was put together by none other than Manuchehr Gurbanifar about the internal power structures inside Iran. Now, I will say, as somebody who has had something to do with Iran as a subject of study in the last 10, 15 years, when you look at that document, it's not that it's completely off the mark. There's actually some interesting stuff in there. But where it's right and where it's wrong, you know, it may seem subtle to somebody who doesn't know a lot about the subject, which very few of these guys did back then. But those differences make a huge difference overall. So they understood their ignorance. When they saw this kind of analysis, they thought, wow, this is fantastic. And Ladin is quoted as going, you know, this is the real deal. This is a breakthrough. And given where they were, you gotta say it was kind of a breakthrough. In that they found somebody as distasteful as Gurbanifar, and as Bruce said, he failed polygraphs constantly. The CIA wanted nothing to do with him. At one point, one of the CIA guys said that he out of 15 questions, he failed on 13, and one of them was his name, kind of thing, you know. But the fact was that by hook or by crook, he was able to establish contacts with no less than an assistant to the prime minister of Iran at that time, Mir Hossein Mousavi, who we all know has kind of changed his stripes and came out as one of the moderate candidates in the 2009 elections. Back then, he was one of the hardliners and was very interested in getting weapons for the war. Now, right there, you've got the kind of disconnect that Barbara's talking about. How is it that you don't know that even though Gurbanifar, the Israelis are telling you you're going to be dealing with moderates and they're going to, you know, help you unseat this regime, very soon after they get started, they see that they're dealing with somebody like Mousavi. They see that they're dealing with people who are self-professed members of the Revolutionary Guards and so on. And they are told repeatedly over the course of a year and a half that the people that they're meeting with include some of the hardline factions. They broke it down into factions of, you know, moderates and hardline and so on. Pretty simplistic, too simplistic to be really helpful ultimately. And yet they refused to see what was right in front of them. And there was even a point after they finally got tired of Gurbanifar and after the failure of the McFarland mission to Tehran in May of 86, the Americans decide, let's ditch this guy, let's find another channel. And they look for the second channel. There's a whole story about that. And it leads them to the nephew of Rafsanjani. Rafsanjani turns out to be, you know, the secret moderate, if you will, at least a guy who has demonstrated an interest in trying to have a better relationship with the United States. For what reasons? You know, I'm sure plenty of reasons. But he had given signals as early as June 85 when the TWA 847 hijacking took place and the Navy diver Robert Steedham was executed and thrown onto the tarmac in a very ugly scene. Rafsanjani personally interceded and helped resolve that crisis. And that, I was able to establish, was registered with people like George Shultz and others, and McFarlane, that this was something that probably helped them think, well, you know, maybe something like this could pan out. But even when they got to Rafsanjani's nephew, as it happens, and they felt they were reaching finally the centers of power, really responsible officials in Iran, one of whom, by the way, was the commander of air defense forces in Iran named Hassan Rouhani. They never met with him, but he was definitely part of it. He's named. They thought, okay, we've got this breakthrough and we're getting to the right people. Well, it doesn't take long before the nephew named Ali Bahramani tells them, good news, folks. This has reached a point where our side is going to form a commission to deal with this issue and to deal with the Americans over a longer term. Americans say, great, who's on the commission? Well, half of them are the same people that they dealt with before. It's the same assistant to Mousavi. It's the same Revolutionary Guard's deputy head of intelligence, who is still around, by the way. His name is Verdi Nejad. He was considered such a negative force by the Americans that the name that they gave him was the monster. The engine because he was driving things, but the monster because he was such a bad guy. He's named to the commission that's going to deal with these situations. So time and again, they are hit in the face with the fact of who they're dealing with, but it never stops them from this misguided adventure.
But how could they believe that they could get the hostages freed if they weren't dealing with the center of power?
Right. Well, they probably would say the proof was in the pudding. They did get three hostages out. It was a long and arduous and frustrating episode, but they did get three hostages out. So they clearly had some kind of contact with people who had influence. Now, there was constant frustration on the American side because they were always being told by Ghorbanifar, you'll get all the hostages out with the next shipment. Promise, you'll get them all out. It never happened. And that's part of why the McFarlane trip was a bust, because McFarlane finally said, no, we're not going to take this anymore. But there was enough of a tease that they were willing to go along with it. Now, never mind that three more hostages were taken in the course of this operation, but no, it's a mystery to some extent.
Right here. Hey, Brian Gibson, LSE. Do you think that the U.S. arms to Iran had a tangible or measurable effect on the Iran-Iraq war?
It's a good question, and I know you're an expert on that war. The official word from the Reagan administration was that absolutely not. This was a minuscule, quote-unquote, amount. As Reagan said in one of his speeches, it could easily fit into the cargo bay of a single aircraft. Now, Ollie North acknowledges that he was tasked to go find a plane big enough to make that real, and of course it's a C-5 transport, and yeah, which could fit, you know, Northern Virginia in it, but that's okay. So their line is these really had no effect whatsoever. When you go back and talk to Iranians and even some American officials, will acknowledge their belief that, in fact, it did have some effect. And I've talked to several Iranians who were in the war, who were at some of these battles like Karbala 5 in early 1987, and scholars who have studied this have done their own interviews with Revolution Guard commanders and so on. And their belief is that it did have an effect, that it helped against tank, you know, counterattacks at Karbala, at that operation. And also there is the view of, there's one guy who was a high-level official in the foreign ministry that I talked to who said that he was pretty sure that the hawks that that they were getting, not just from, they were getting from other countries as well, that those kinds of weapons did have an effect on Iraqi attacks or willingness or readiness to attack Iranian cities. I don't know how you quite nail that down to be sure. Was it those TOW missiles that actually had the effect? Was it something else? But there is evidence to that effect. And of course the Iraqis, we now know, believe the same thing because Saddam Hussein and some of his officials, their papers were taken by American forces when they occupied the place in 2003. And some of those are now available, and they've been studied and produced. You've probably been there to the place. I've listened to some of these tapes of Saddam talking to his advisors and read some of the transcripts. And of course, this is a whole other chapter of the story. What was their reaction when this affair became public? Well, of course, they were shocked. To some degree, they were shocked. Saddam claims he wasn't really shocked. He always knew that these people were reprobates and untrustworthy, these Americans. But not surprisingly, they also believe that that the weapons had an effect.
I'm going to take one from the further back. Can we go all the way back here?
Thank you. I'm Leon Weinscheid, University of Wisconsin. I was in the State Department at the time this was all happening. I wonder if you could kind of set the scene for what led to this. I'm glad that our earlier speaker mentioned the hostages in Lebanon. You know, we have the history of the civil war in Lebanon, continual hostages. I wonder if you could kind of set the scene of the kind of pressure this was putting on the White House, on the number of hostages, on the number of deaths and executions of hostages. Kind of help us understand what was an essential driver in all of this.
Well, they were absolutely at the heart of this, as you know. And there was great pressure. There was, as I said earlier, there was personal pressure and political pressure. I don't doubt for a second Reagan's genuine desire to see them come home. As Bruce will be able to tell you much better than I, but from the readings and interviews that I've done, it's clear to everybody that counterterrorism and prevention of hostage taking was a huge focus for the Reagan administration, and they built up the infrastructure to an extraordinary degree, and they had a lot of successes. You know, Charles Allen will tell you that, other than this kind of blip, there was a lot to be proud of in his work in the Reagan administration. So hostages were central. As one CIA guy said, in addition to the personal side, Reagan was acutely aware of the yellow ribbon phenomenon. We all remember that during the Iran hostage saga, the takeover of our embassy in 1979 produced, you know, tens of thousands of yellow ribbons all over the United States. And there's no question that Reagan was determined not to see that phenomenon happen again. There was also a particular concern in a few personal instances, and the main one being the fate of the CIA officer William Buckley, who was tragically reassigned to Beirut very shortly after he had left, and this apparently violated tradecraft by putting him in danger by relocating him there so soon after he had departed. And sure enough, he got bundled off fairly early on in 1984. This is when this all started. There was one hostage, David Dodge, in 82, and another one, I think, in 83. But 84 is really where this next phase starts. And Buckley was the guy that was of most concern to Bill Casey, to McFarlane, and to others. And, of course, we know that he was tortured, and he died, and reportedly produced from it a 400-page transcript of his agonized, discussions with these people who took him. That created huge pressure for the intelligence community as well as for the president. And in fact, the hope was that Buckley would be the first guy released. That was what the McFarlane wanted from the first August 1985 shipment of TOW missiles. And nobody came out. And Buckley, of course, never did.
And of course, since Casey had sent Buckley to Beirut, he felt a personal as well as professional responsibility here. Gary.
Thanks, Mr. Byrne. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I also want to say that I did get the memo about socks, but my Argyles were at the laundry, so I couldn't.
We'd have you up here otherwise.
Yeah, but, right. Yeah. There's one name that hasn't come up yet, and I'm interested to know where is George H.W. Bush in all of this, and what does that tell us about the pardons?
Well, excellent question. George H.W. Bush, in my reading of it, was making sure that he left no footprints in the sand wherever he went. If I can find the document here. He, as you remember, came under a lot of scrutiny when he was running for president to succeed Reagan in 1988. And his whole story was, I didn't know anything. I was out of the loop. I wasn't in the cockpit. It was a difficult line for him to tread because he's trying to show himself simultaneously as, you know, right there with the Gipper and yet, you know, conveniently off stage when trouble hit. It turns out that Bush left a diary of sorts that was not known about until way late in the investigations. And this is a whole other aspect of the saga, and it goes partly to answer your question of what was the reaction of the administration to the investigations. Well, sad to say, the reaction of several key officials was to take their personal notes and hide them and withhold them from the independent counsel, who was treated as the devil incarnate by a lot of them. Now, there's some controversy over whether Weinberger's material was available at the Library of Congress and so on, but the fact is, it's very clear, at least to me, that these guys knew exactly what they were doing, and they withheld this stuff deliberately in order to protect themselves. Well, Bush was no example, and this is a page from his, it's called the Bush Diary. He started keeping it on November 4th, 1986, the day after the Iran deals became known. But he did it allegedly for his own purposes to record his upcoming campaign. And he would dictate onto a tape, and a secretary would transcribe it. So the very second day of his notes, these all came out through the independent counsel, who eventually recovered the notes and diaries of Weinberger, of George Shultz's aide, Charlie Hill, of Donald Regan, and one or two others, all of whom claimed they never kept notes and didn't have anything of the sort. Outrageous. Okay, so November 5th, this is Bush's diary. On the news at this time is the question of the hostages. There is some discussion of Bud McFarlane having been held prisoner in Iran for 4 days. I'm one of the few people that know fully the details, and there is a lot of flack and misinformation out there. It is not a subject we can talk about. Weinberger also has notes that show that Bush was very much involved, and so does Shultz's aide, Charlie Hill. I would love to try to read some of this, but let's see. You know, I think I won't read it, but there's a lot of just fantastic material that's out there. And in this case that I'm thinking of, there are conversations between Shultz and Bush, where Shultz is saying, not just with Shultz and Bush, but Shultz coming back from meetings and talking to Charlie Hill and others going, oh my God, what is happening here? This is in late November 86 when the trouble has hit the fan. And Shultz keeps going to these meetings at the White House and coming back going, this is another Watergate. These people are lying. They're falling into the same trap. And the vice president is one of them. Who does he think he's kidding? He was there. He was in the room. This is, you know, there's almost quotes. And he, to his credit, he confronts Bush, and he, more as a kind of a friendly warning, he said, you've got to watch out what you're doing here because you're treading a very fine line. And, you know that you approve these things. And so you've got to be careful what you said. And Bush says, I'm very careful. But truer words were never spoken. And Schultz comes back and says, well, you know, you may think you're being right in what you're saying, but you can't be technically right. You have to be right, and be careful where this leads you. Very strong stuff that show there's no doubt whatsoever, not only on the Iran side, but also on the Contra side. The one whole aspect of the scandal, the scandal of dealing with the Contras, had to do with attempts by not Ali North, who was certainly very busy doing all kinds of illegal stuff, there's no question about that, but of higher-ups, including the vice president and others, in their attempts to try to get foreign governments to donate money that Congress refused to appropriate. There's a whole legal question about this. These were known as quid pro quo deals. And the question surrounded whether or not it's legal to do a quid pro quo deal with a foreign government. And the short answer is no, it's not. You can have a conversation with the head of state, as McFarlane or Reagan did with King Fahd and McFarlane did with Prince Bandar beforehand. And if that conversation results in the foreign leader saying, you know, I think we can help you out here, and we'd like to make a donation. That's okay. But what clearly happened on a number of occasions was American officials going to these guys, and Bush is one of them, going to talk to Roberto Suazo Cordova in Honduras, and saying to them bluntly, we need your help. We need you to keep going with the Contras, help, you know, host them on your territory. Help us, you know, get some weapons shipments through, give us money, whatever the situation is. And Bush is on the record as having made that kind of approach to Suazo. And in each of these cases, the head of state or the official, whoever it is also on paper saying, well, what's in it for us? How are you going to help us? Even King Fahd, it's seen as just kind of a nice gesture that Fahd gives. I don't think I have this document with me. But I just recently found a document that is an NSPG meeting set of minutes, National Security Planning Group, you know, more tightly held than the National Security Council. And it's discussing the escalation of conflict in the Persian Gulf. It's in May 1985. Earlier in 1984, in May 84, and then in February 1985, the Saudis, in two stages, tell McFarlane and Reagan that they are going to give a lot of money to the Contras. The first tranche is $1 million a month. Bandar tells this to McFarlane. McFarlane reports it to Reagan. Reagan says, that's great. Then Reagan meets with Fahd, and Fahd says, I'm going to double it, $2 million a month. Well, shortly after that happens, by coincidence, there's a meeting of the NSPG, and it starts off with John Poindexter saying, okay, we've just gotten an urgent request from King Fahd to help them out in these various ways in the Persian Gulf because, you know, shipping is being attacked and it's time for us to step up and do something. So this is the subject of this meeting. Well, it doesn't take, you know, a math genius to add two and two together and see that there is an expectation there. And that was the case even more explicitly in all of these other instances, including one case where Bush admittedly went down to Honduras to try to cut the same deal with Suazo.
If my memory is right, you also describe in the book a meeting at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem between the vice president and the Israelis. You've alluded to this before, but I want to zero in on a little bit more. As I read the scandal, it would never have happened, or let me put it differently. The idea of arms to hostages, arms to Iran, arms in general for Iran, whether or not they're for hostages or for strategic reasons or for whatever, would never have stood in Washington without the Israelis saying this is the right thing to do. This book is not about Israeli foreign policy, but how would you characterize the weight which Israel had in moving the United States in this direction, and particularly the weight that Shimon Peres, one of the most respected figures, probably will be up there with David Ben-Gurion in the history of Israel, had in moving us into this, what turned out to be, disaster.
Right. There's no question that they played a key role, not only in helping spark it, as I said earlier on, but encouraging it as the process went on. It wasn't completely one side, though. There were clearly people on the American side who were uncomfortable about this, and George Shultz was one of them, and George Bush was another one, who were skittish about too much of an Israeli role. And one of Shultz's criticisms, which he says in one of his, you know, angst-ridden discussions with Charlie Hill, is that the problem is that when we do this kind of thing, even if the president says it's minuscule and so on, it opens the door for Israel to do even more. And there was, of course, a past history going back, you know, almost to immediately after the revolution, of Israel providing arms and spare parts to Iran, often in spite of American disapproval. And I talk about this to some extent as sort of the lead up to it. A lot of pressure from Israel saying, let us do it, let us do it, you know. And even Menachem Begin, early on, uses as some of his arguments, the same arguments that Kimke uses,
right,
which is, you know, we can get you intelligence, we can get you in good with some of these moderates, and we think this can work. Adding, just to go back to Barbara's question, adding just a shred of legitimacy to this notion of moderates is the Israeli argument that one of their best sets of relationships with the old regime was with the military. And they claimed, we still have friends who are still in the military, and we think that they may be able to be helpful. That's a little strand that goes through now and then. It's not just, one of the interesting things to me about this story is the personal side of it, and it's not just the ability of one government to sort of home in on what they think is going to register with the other government, which is the United States. But it's also the interplay of personalities, and it's striking how many of these people have, you know, twins in the other country.
Right.
And Peres is sort of Reagan's twin in a sense. I mean, I went to Israel and I interviewed a bunch of people who were involved, and to a person, they said, Peres is this crazy, out-of-the-box guy who comes up with these ideas. As Tom Pickering said at one point, Peres has, you know, a million ideas, 2% of which are really brilliant. So he's willing to go out of the box and do this kind of stuff, like Casey also, and doesn't care what the rest of his group thinks. He's got an arrangement with Rabin and Shamir, a power-sharing arrangement. They all get together. They don't necessarily like each other. They don't like what they're doing, but, you know, they know their turn's going to come, so they'll allow certain things to go forward. On the operational level, there's another sort of separated at birth story, which is a counterterrorism advisor to Peres named Amiram Nir, who met an untimely death after this event that is still the subject of much interest. He was North's twin separated at birth. I mean, just a maverick guy, had no real experience in the field, made as many lifelong friends as he did enemies, charming, gregarious guy, hated by the Mossad, reportedly, but able to sort of cozy up to people like Peres and others and be able to have a lot of influence. And the two of them got together and they just melded. They had a mind meld and they worked on all kinds of secret operations that are alluded to in some of North's notes that never saw the light of day. But they had all kinds of wacky ideas about how to expand their operation beyond just the Iran side.
More questions right here.
Since you've spent so much, Kenneth Rothschild. Since you spent so much time thinking about this, and this is a very, very interesting talk, I'd be interested to know your opinion on how we're going to move forward as a culture, not just America, but the human population. I mean, this has been going on forever. You go back way into our history with the Mexican, everything's been distorted and mismanaged and taken advantage of. Have you come to any ideas about how we can move forward as a human culture to avoid these types of things? Because inevitably, it's the average person whose money is being misspent and whose lives are being taken and the populations, local populations disturbed. And it's a big question, but do you have any thoughts about that?
Fortunately, it's a history book, so I don't need to. That's not a policy book or a psychology book. But yeah, you can't help but think about those things. And so, not being an expert in any of those other areas, all I can do is throw out some general reactions which relate to this case. And those are that you need to have people in office who take their responsibilities seriously. You need to, as a population, we need to do more to hold them accountable. We need to be less in thrall of their arguments that we are, we're facing some kind of crisis, because there's always a crisis. 9/11 being an example. It's not that they aren't real, but we have to be more aware of how often, as you say, these kinds of things have happened, and that it's up to us, it's up to the media, it's up to Congress, it's up to the courts, and it's up to the officials themselves to hold themselves and for us to hold them to a higher standard. And one of my deep regrets about this whole scandal is I think that it cheapened that. It lessened that sense by letting these guys get away with it and by giving them... the ones who worked so hard to try to minimize the responsibility and excuse and justify the actions, by giving them so much credence when the evidence seems so stark in the other direction. And I'm talking not just about Ollie North, who, used traveler's checks when he shouldn't have and took... an illegal gratuity and took all kinds of liberties, but also, all the way up to Reagan himself and Ed Meese and all the other guys. I believe that it could not have had any other effect but to give the American people the sense that, there doesn't need to be a higher standard for these guys. They're just like you and me. I mean, this is why I think the North trial had the result that it did in popular reaction. It's like, well, the jury came out and said, I can put myself in his shoes. He's just a regular guy at work. And yeah, we all cut corners. We all do certain things. No, we don't shred evidence. We don't lie at every opportunity to our colleagues, to our superiors, to, our counterparts, to the public, to Congress. You should find that you're facing serious consequences for that kind of thing. And I just got the sense at the time, and again, reading back into it, that sort of sense of ethical responsibility just took a nosedive after this episode. Okay.
Hi, I'm Shane Harris with Foreign Policy Magazine, and a couple of years ago wrote a book largely about John Poindexter, so we had a chance to talk about a lot of this, which was great. Two questions, one Contra and one Iran. I don't think I heard you say in your remarks, and maybe I'm sure you go into it in the book, where do you come down on whether Reagan knew about the diversion or authorized it, sort of that key question that links Iran and Contra together? And the second is, how do you think the Obama administration now, which is, of course, grappling with this issue of negotiating for terrorists, and there seems to be a lot of gray area even around the question of whether ransoms are being paid, maybe not by the U.S., maybe by others, what lessons do you think they should be drawing from how the Reagan administration handled it and sort of what pitfalls they should hope to avoid?
So the diversion question was the Watergate question of the Iran-Contra scandal, and I argue, and others have argued, that that was a mistake to consider that the central question that, that it was put out to be. And several of us, including Ollie North, me and Ollie, agree that it was basically a really clever idea of Ed Meese to divert everybody down the wrong path. So as North says, the diversion was a diversion. Why? Because in the course of his investigation, Meese's investigation, I mean, that's way too too big a word for it. Meese's damage control operation from November 21st to 24th, 1986, his aim was to find out what this diversion was all about, because that's when they found out, found this memo, which I have a copy of here, where North says, okay, we're going to have this arms sale to Iran, and I'm going to take $12 million, and I'm going to give it to the Contras. It's a prospective thing. It's not a something that happened. And when Meese's deputies find it, they go and ask him, and his first question is, was there a cover memo on that? And they go, why? Oh, no reason. You know, well, because the cover memo would have said the president has seen or something like that. It's an important question because it does identify an act that virtually everybody except North sees as a blatantly illegal act. But it does deflect from the other key issues that were at play then. When Meese was able to figure out that the president could deny ever having known anything about the diversion, then it became safe to go in front of the public and say, there was this diversion. What a terrible thing. But don't worry. We're on top of it. We've fired the guy who did it.
Right.
His boss has resigned. And then, you know, we're going to look into this some more. What Meese was really worried about at that point, before he found the diversion memo, was the realization that Reagan had authorized three shipments to terrorists in Iran without any of the legal groundwork that was necessary to do that, without signing a finding, without reporting to Congress, without any of that stuff. And he says himself, that is a violation. He tells Shultz, that is a violation. He says, I don't think the president knew about it. Shultz, in the same conversation, tells him, no, I just talked to the president. And he said, oh, yeah, I knew that. I mean, it's the blatant cover-up by Meese when they have a couple of other meetings with all the high-level people, and they basically spin the story. Okay, here's what happened. The president didn't know. Okay, and nobody says anything. And Shultz comes back going, oh, my God, they're building a wall around the president, here we go. But at the meeting, nobody says a thing, even though Weinberger knows he knew it. Reagan knows that Reagan knew it. They all, you know. Okay, so as far as whether Reagan did, in fact, know, this was the big question and huge disagreement among all concerned, among investigators, among anybody that you talk to. Half of them can't believe that Reagan didn't know about it, because this is one of his most, important subjects for him, policy topics. His aides know that. His aides, as Bruce know, on the Iran side, did nothing but try to go out and get some answer to the hostages. Every meeting that you had, as I understand it, ended with, you know, well, what are we going to tell the president about where the hostages are? It was the same with the Contras. Is it conceivable that Reagan would just stop asking questions about how we're keeping these guys together, body and soul, for 2 years? Seems inconceivable. The other half says, well, you know, but Poindexter is just taking he was such an arrogant guy that he saw it as fully within his, you know, responsibility to decide what the president knew and didn't know, and that's what he said and during the hearings. Sat there looking like a gray ghost and, you know, puffing on his pipe and saying, nope, the buck stopped here with me. Well, I interviewed him, too. I found him completely fascinating, and I started leaning in the direction of going, wow, maybe he's actually telling the truth. And to this day, he says, I never told the president because I knew he needed deniability. On the other hand, he says, I told him everything else that happened. And he knew all about what Ollie North was doing. He knew about Richard Secord. He knew about all this because we talked about it all the time. We talked about how the NSC staff, you know, should be conducting covert operations. We did all that stuff. Well, if he's willing to say that, because that to me makes it an impeachable offense. If Reagan knew all about that stuff that his own staff was doing in direct violation of the Bolin Amendment, whatever you think of the Bolin Amendment, it's the law of the land, and it was clear enough. Then, you know, imagine Obama in that same situation, if you're asking sort of comparisons with Obama. How long would Obama last if that information came out, at least before calls for impeachment came out? If Poindexter's willing to admit to all that, what's in it for him to say, you know, I kept that a secret, if that's not true? And to my mind, Poindexter is a much more loyal servant than North is. North used those hearings to spill his guts. Why? Because they had a smart lawyer who said, you're going to be going on trial soon, but we're getting you immunity for anything that you say here. So whatever you got to say, say it. Poindexter didn't take that route. Poindexter got found guilty on all of his charges. North didn't. Now, both of them had their charges vacated because of the immunized testimony problem. But Poindexter was in a position to do just what North did and save his own skin, and he didn't. He took all of the heat for that. So that gives him some credibility. I don't say I know for sure, but it's a fascinating question.
We've unfortunately reached the witching hour. You had a second question if you want to make a comment about hostage lessons learned.
Maybe I can deflect it a little bit and talk about U.S.-Iran relations a bit and just say, and there are people who know a lot about more about this than I do, but my sense over the years is that the U.S. has slowly, slowly, slowly been learning lessons. And the Reagan period offered several lessons. First of all, there are people there that you can talk to. It's not 100% clear what they want from us, but there's enough evidence from people like George Cave, the retiree from the CIA who was part of this mission, and others who firmly believe that that some Iranians wanted more than just weapons. They wanted to talk longer term. That's a very interesting lesson. But, of course, the scandal from this just put all thought of contacts of that sort into the deep freeze for a while. That's one of the bad outcomes of this operation. But each president seemed to have to discover something for himself. So Clinton, for instance, decided, okay, we've got a new guy, a moderate Khatami in office. Let's try to make an approach to him. But let's do it directly. We won't do it through intermediaries who can't be trusted the way that Reagan did. Fine. So they write a letter to Khatami in 1999 that Bruce made possible and helped to convey to the Iranians indirectly. But it blows up in their face. Why? Because Khatami isn't the guy you should be addressing it to. It's the supreme leader you should be addressing it to. Well, Obama seems to have figured that out. Now, what kind of effect that's had, hard to say, but there are these kinds of, you know, pieces of evidence that the U.S. is gradually picking up from each of their predecessors. On hostages, I pity the people whose profession it is to try to work this stuff out, because in the course of digging through all of this dross of the weird operations that these guys did, there's a lot of material out there about what else was happening and the incredible lengths to which people went and, you know, creating these different organizations, the Terrorist Incident Working Group, the Hostage Location Task Force, the Operations Subgroup. I mean, a huge amount of effort went into trying to figure out how to get these guys out, whether to mount a rescue operation or so on. It always came down to not having enough intelligence. Where are these people right now? And where are they going to be when we want to go in? Nobody ever seemed to be able to figure that out. And I think now, as you know, ISIS is showing, it's like everything evolves. And back then, even though Reagan at one point was terrified that the hostages were going to be executed, just as Carter was afraid his hostages would be executed. And in fact, there's a great memo, another memo from one of these meetings where Reagan showing a decisive side that I think a lot of people might be surprised about, approves undertaking military strikes and other acts like that against not just Hezbollah, but in my reading of it, against Iranian targets as well, if anything happens to those hostages. And the meeting ends with Poindexter saying, okay, if this happens, we're going to conduct these strikes. And the notes say Reagan, snapping his fingers, goes like that. And Poindexter even, you know, the crazy Poindexter says, well, don't you think we should have one more meeting just to confirm that? And Reagan goes, nope, only if it doesn't delay the strikes. And of course, there's blacked out text on all sides. But the lesson is you got to be super careful, because if you don't get it right, then I think, you know, the ISIS is showing that the stakes are as high as all of these folks fear.
Well, I think this last hour and a half has given you just a sample. It's a great book. I urge you to get it. We have copies on sale here. And I want to thank you, Malcolm, for coming today. I want to thank you for writing the book, and thank all of you for being here.
Thank you.